audiobook MP3 of The Day After Roswell, Colonel Philip J. Corso, William J. Burnies. 2. Contents. Foreword, Introduction. Foreword. Senator Strom Thurmond. When I was first elected to the United States Senate in 1954, the United States and Democratic Western governments were locked in a bitter, and sometimes deadly, Cold War with totalitarian communist governments that sought to expand their bankrupt ideology throughout the world. Though those who did not live during this era have a hard time picturing it, the 1950s and 1960s were a period in our history when there was a very real need to be concerned about a communist, especially Soviet, threat to our security and institutions. As a member of the Senate Armed Services Committee, I took a lead role in seeking out those in our government who sought to muzzle military personnel who wanted to alert Americans to the threats we faced from our communist enemies and to speak out against some of the plainly misguided, incorrect and, frankly, dangerous policies of the United States in dealing with the Soviets and Red Chinese. Distinguished officers and patriotic men such as Admiral Arleigh Burke and General Arthur Trudeau were essentially censored by their own government because of the views they espoused about the state of the world and the nature of the threat before our nation. As a veteran of World War II, a commissioned officer in the United States Army Reserve, and a proponent of a strong and comprehensive military, I could not sit idly by and watch our military be undermined by people in government who were sympathetic to communism. During this period, the Armed Services Committee held extensive hearings into this matter. It seemed an alien concept that in a nation that protects and cherishes free expression, the men who risked their lives to keep us free and best understood how we should confront our enemies would be ordered silent. It was under these circumstances that I came to know Philip Corso, then a colonel in the United States Army, who was equally disturbed about the muzzling of our military, and who shared my concern about the future of our military forces. As the members of the Armed Services Committee worked diligently to discover who was working to quiet our soldiers, sailors, Marines, and airmen, Colonel Corso was brought to my attention by two of my former staff members. The colonel had a great deal of credibility and expertise not only as a military officer but also in the fields of intelligence and national security. A veteran of World War II and Korea, Corso had also spent 4 years working at the National Security Council. In short, he was very familiar with issues that concerned me and my colleagues on the Senate Armed Services Committee, and he very quickly became a valued source of bountiful information that was insightful and, most important, accurate. As a matter of fact, the material he provided was invaluable in helping us prove that the stifling of American military officers was being ordered by individuals in high-ranking positions within our own government. In 1963, when I learned of Colonel Corso's impending retirement from the Army, I thought that having a man with his background and experiences on my staff would be of great benefit. So after offering him a position that promised nothing more than long hours of hard work at a modest salary, Philip Corso once again willingly went to work serving and protecting the United States, this time as an aide in my office. There is no question that Philip Corso has led a full and adventurous life, and I am certain that he has many interesting stories to share with individuals interested in military history, espionage, and the workings of our government. We should all be grateful that there are men and women like Colonel Corso, people who are willing to dedicate their lives to serving the nation and protecting the ideals we all hold dear, and we should honor the sacrifices they have made in their careers and in their lives. Introduction. My name is Philip J. Corso, and for 2 incredible years back in the 1960s while I was a lieutenant colonel in the Army heading up the Foreign Technology Desk in Army Research and Development at the Pentagon, I led a double life. In my routine everyday job as a researcher and evaluator of weapons systems for the Army, I investigated things like the helicopter armament the French military had developed, the tactical deployment complexities of a theater anti-missile missile, or new technologies to preserve and prepare meals for our troops in the field. I read technology reports and met with engineers at Army Proving Grounds about different kinds of ordnance and how ongoing budgeted development projects were moving forward. I submitted their reports to my boss, Lieutenant General Arthur Trudeau, the Director of Army R&D and the manager of a 3,000-plus man operation with lots of projects at different stages. On the surface, especially to congressmen exercising oversight as to how the taxpayers' money was being spent, all of it was routine stuff. Part of my job responsibility in Army R&D, research and development, however, was as an intelligence officer and advisor to General Trudeau, who, himself, had headed up Army intelligence before coming to R&D. This was a job I was trained for and held during World War II and Korea. At the Pentagon, I was working in some of the most secret areas of military intelligence, reviewing heavily classified information on behalf of General Trudeau. I had been on General MacArthur's staff in Korea and knew that as late as 1961, even as late, maybe, as today, as Americans back then were sitting down to watch Dr. Kildare or Gunsmoke, captured American soldiers from World War II and Korea were still living in gulag conditions in prison camps in the Soviet Union and Korea. Some of them were undergoing what amounted to sheer psychological torture. They were the men who never returned. As an intelligence officer, I also knew the terrible secret that some of our government's most revered institutions had been penetrated by the KGB and that key aspects of American foreign policy were being dictated from inside the Kremlin. I testified to this first at a Senate subcommittee hearing chaired by Senator Everett Dirksen of Illinois in April 1962, and a month later delivered the same information to Attorney General Robert Kennedy. He promised me that he would deliver it to his brother, the president, and I have every reason to believe he did. It was ironic that in 1964, after I retired from the Army and had served on Senator Strom Thurmond's staff, I worked for Warren Commission member Senator Richard Russell as an investigator. But hidden beneath everything I did, at the center of a double life I led that no one knew about, and buried deep inside my job at the Pentagon, was a single-file cabinet that I had inherited because of my intelligence background. That file held the Army's deepest and most closely guarded secret, the Roswell files, the cache of debris and information an Army retrieval team from the 509th Army Airfield pulled out of the wreckage of a flying disc that had crashed outside the town of Roswell in the New Mexico desert in the early morning darkness during the first week of July 1947. The Roswell file was the legacy of what happened in the hours and days after the crash when the official government cover-up was put into place. As the military tried to figure out what it was that had crashed, where it had come from, and what its inhabitants' intentions were, a covert group was assembled under the leadership of the Director of Intelligence, Admiral Roskohilenko Etta, to investigate the nature of the flying discs and collect all information about encounters with these phenomena while, at the same time, publicly and officially discounting the existence of all flying saucers. This operation has been going on, in one form or another, for 50 years amidst complete secrecy. I wasn't in Roswell in 1947, nor had I heard any details about the crash at that time because it was kept so tightly under wraps, even within the military. You can easily understand why, though, if you remember, as I do, the Mercury Theater War of the Worlds radio broadcast in 1938 when the entire country panicked at the story of how invaders from Mars landed in Grover's Mill, New Jersey, and began attacking the local populace. The fictionalized eyewitness reports of violence and the inability of our military forces to stop the creatures were graphic. They killed everyone who crossed their path, narrator Orson Welles said into his microphone, as these creatures in their war machines started their march toward New York. The level of terror that Halloween night of the broadcast was so intense and the military so incapable of protecting the local residents that the police were overwhelmed by the phone calls. It was as if the whole country had gone crazy and authority itself had started to unravel. Now, in Roswell in 1947, the landing of a flying saucer was no fantasy. It was real, the military wasn't able to prevent it, And this time the authorities didn't want a repeat of War of the Worlds. So you can see the mentality at work behind the desperate need to keep the story quiet. And this is not to mention the military fears at first that the craft might have been an experimental Soviet weapon because it bore a resemblance to some of the German-designed aircraft that had made their appearances near the end of the war, especially the crescent-shaped Horten flying wing. What if the Soviets had developed their own version of this craft? The stories about the Roswell crash vary from one another in the details. Because I wasn't there, I've had to rely on reports of others, even within the military itself. Through the years, I've heard versions of the Roswell story in which campers, an archaeological team, or Ansha MacBrazel found the wreckage. I've read military reports about different crashes in different locations in some proximity to the Army airfield at Roswell, like San Agustin and Corona, and even different sites close to the town itself. All of the reports were classified, and I did not copy them or retain them for my own records after I left the Army. Sometimes the dates of the crash vary from report to report, July 2nd or 3 as opposed to July 4th. And I've heard different people argue the dates back and forth, establishing timelines that vary from one another in details, but all agree that something crashed in the desert outside of Roswell and near enough to the Army's most sensitive installations at Alamogordo and White Sands that it caused the Army to react quickly and with concern as soon as it found out. In 1961, regardless of the differences in the Roswell story from the many different sources who had described it, the top, secret file of Roswell information came into my possession when I took over the Foreign Technology Desk at R&D. My boss, General Trudeau, asked me to use the Army's ongoing weapons development and research program as a way to filter the Roswell technology into the mainstream of industrial development through the military defense contracting program. Today, items such as lasers, integrated circuitry, fiber optics networks, accelerated particle beam devices, and even the Kevlar material in bulletproof vests are all commonplace. Yet the seeds for the development of all of them were found in the crash of the alien craft at Roswell and turned up in my files 14 years later. But that's not even the whole story. In those confusing hours after the discovery of the crashed Roswell alien craft, the Army determined that in the absence of any other information it had to be an extraterrestrial. Worse, the fact that this craft and other flying saucers had been surveilling our defensive installations and even seemed to evidence a technology we'd seen evidenced by the Nazis caused the military to assume these flying saucers had hostile intentions and might have even interfered in human events during the war. We didn't know what the inhabitants of these crafts wanted, but we had to assume from their behavior, especially their interventions in the lives of human beings and the reported cattle mutilations, that they could be potential enemies. That meant that we were facing a far superior power with weapons capable of obliterating us. At the same time, we were locked in a cold war with the Soviets and the mainland Chinese and were faced with the penetration of our own intelligence agencies by the KGB. The military found itself fighting a two-front war, a war against the communists who were seeking to undermine our institutions while threatening our allies and, as unbelievable as it sounds, a war against extraterrestrials, who posed an even greater threat than the communist forces. So we used the extraterrestrials' own technology against them, feeding it out to our defense contractors and then adapting it for use in space, related defense systems. It took us until the 1980s, but in the end we were able to deploy enough of the Strategic Defense Initiative, Star Wars, to achieve the capability of knocking down enemy satellites, killing the electronic guidance systems of incoming enemy warheads, and disabling enemy spacecraft, if we had to pose a threat. It was alien technology that we used, lasers, accelerated particle beam weapons, and aircraft equipped with stealth features. And in the end, we not only outlasted the Soviets and ended the Cold War, but we forced a stalemate with the extraterrestrials, who were not so invulnerable after all. What happened after Roswell? how we turned the extraterrestrials' technology against them, and how we actually won the Cold War is an incredible story. During the thick of it, I didn't even realize how incredible it was. I just did my job, going to work with the Pentagon day in and day out until we put enough of this alien technology into development that it began to move forward under its own weight through industry and back into the Army. The full import of what we did at Army R&D and what General Trudeau did to grow R&D from a disorganized unit under the shadow of the Advanced Research Projects Agency, when he first took 6. Command, to the Army Department that helped create the military guided missile, the anti-missile missile, and the guided missile launched accelerated particle beam firing satellite killer, didn't really hit me until years later when I understood just how we were able to make history. I always thought of myself as just a little man from a little American town in western Pennsylvania, and I didn't assess the weight of our accomplishments at Army R&D, especially how we harvested the technology coming out of the Roswell crash, until 35 years after I left the Army when I sat down to write my memoirs for an entirely different book. That was when I reviewed my old journals, remembered some of the memos I'd written to General Trudeau, and understood that the story of what happened in the days after the Roswell crash was perhaps the most significant story of the past 50 years. So, believe it or not, this is the story of what happened in the days after Roswell and how a small group of military intelligence officers changed the course of human history. Chapter 1. The Roswell Desert. The night hugs the ground and swallows you up as you drive out of Albuquerque and into the desert. As you head east along 40 and then south along 285 to Roswell, there's only you and the tiny universe ahead of you defined by your headlights. On either side, beyond the circle of light, there is only scrub and sand. The rest is all darkness that closes in behind you, flooding where you've been under a giant ocean of black, and pushes you forward along the few hundred feet of road directly ahead. The sky is different out there, different from any sky you've ever seen before. The black is so clear it looks like the stars shining through it are tiny windows from the beginning of time, millions of them, going on forever. On a hot summer night you can sometimes see flashes of heat lightning explode in the distance. Somewhere it is light for an instant, then the darkness returns. But summer is the rainy season in the New Mexico desert, and thunderstorms assemble over you out of nowhere, pound the earth with rain and lightning, pummel the darkness with crashes of thunder, shake the ground until you feel the earth is breaking apart, and then disappear. The ranchers out there will tell you that the local storms can go on all night, bouncing off the arroyos like pinballs in play until they expend themselves over the horizon. That's what it was like 50 years ago on a night much like this. Although I wasn't there that night, I've heard many different versions. Many of them go like this: base radar at the Army's 509th airfield outside the town of Roswell had been tracking strange blips all night on July 1, 1947. So had radar at nearby White Sands, the Army's guided missile base where test launches of German V-2 rockets had been taking place since the end of the war, and at the nuclear testing facility at Alamogordo. The blips would appear at one corner of the screen and dart across at seemingly impossible speeds for aircraft, only to disappear off another corner. Then they'd start up again. No earthly craft could have maneuvered at such speeds and changed direction so sharply. It was a signature no one could identify. Whether it was the same aircraft, more than one, or simply an anomaly from the violent lightning and thunderstorms was anybody's guess. So after the operators verified the calibrations of the radar equipment, they broke down the units to run diagnostic checks on the circuitry of the screen imaging devices to make sure their radar panels were operating properly. Once they'd satisfied themselves that they couldn't report any equipment malfunction, the controllers were forced to assume that the screen images were displays of something that was truly out there. They confirmed the sightings with radar controllers at White Sands, but found they could do little else but track the blips as they darted across the screen with every sweep of the silent beacon. The blips swarmed from position to position at will, operating with complete freedom across the entire sky over the Army's most secret nuclear and missile testing sites. Throughout that night and the following day, Army intelligence stayed on high alert because something strange was going on out there. Surveillance flights over the desert reported no sightings of strange objects either in the sky or on the ground, but any sighting of unidentified aircraft on radar was sufficient evidence for base commanders to assume a hostile intent on the part of something. And that was why the Army intelligence in Washington ordered additional counterintelligence personnel to New Mexico, especially to 7, the 509th, where the activity seemed to be centered. The radar anomalies continued into the next night as Dan Wilmot, owner of a hardware store in Roswell, set up chairs on his front porch after dinner to watch the streaks of lightning flash across the sky in the distance. Shortly before 10 that evening, the lightning grew more intense and the ground shook under the explosions of thunder from a summer storm that pounded the chaparral off in the northwest of the city. Dan and his wife watched the spectacle from beneath the dry safety of their porch roof. It was as if each new bolt of lightning were a spear that bent the heavens themselves. Better than any 4th of July fireworks, the Wilmots must have been remarking as they watched in awe as a bright oval object streaked over their house and headed off into the northwest, sinking below a rise just before the horizon where it was engulfed in darkness. The sky again became pitch black. By the time the next bolt of lightning shot off, the object was gone. A most unusual sight, Dan Wilmot thought, but it was gone from his sight and gone from his thoughts, at least until the end of the week. Whatever it was that passed over the Wilmot house in Roswell also flew over Steve Robinson as he drove his milk truck along its route north of the city. Robinson tracked the object as it shot across the sky at speeds faster than any airplane he'd ever seen. It was a bright object, he noted, elliptical and solid rather than a sequence of lights like the military aircraft that flew in and out of the 509th airfield on the city's outskirts. It disappeared behind a rise off in the west toward Albuquerque, and Steve put it out of his mind as he pushed forward on his route. To the civilians in Roswell, nothing was amiss. Summer thunderstorms were common, the reports of flying saucers in the newspapers and over the radio were simply circus sideshow amusements, and an object streaking across the sky that so attracted the Wilmots' attention could have been nothing more than the shooting star you make a wish on if you're lucky enough to see it before it disappears forever in a puff of flame. Soon it would be the July 4th weekend, and the Wilmots, Steve Robinson, and thousands of other local residents were looking forward to the unofficial start of the summer holiday. But at the 509th there was no celebrating. The isolated incidents of unidentified radar blips at Roswell and White Sands continued to increase over the next couple of days until it looked like a steady stream of airspace violations. Now it was becoming more than serious. There was no denying that a traffic pattern of strange aircraft overflights was emerging in the skies over the New Mexico desert where, with impunity, these unidentifiable radar blips hovered above and then darted away from our most secret military installations. By the time the military's own aircraft scrambled, the intruders were gone. It was obvious to the base commanders that they were under a heavy surveillance from a presence they could only assume was hostile. At first, nobody gave much thought to the possibility of extraterrestrials or flying saucers, even though they'd been in the news for the past few weeks that spring. Army officers at the 509th and White Sands thought it was the Russians spying on the military's first nuclear bomber base and its guided, missile launching site. By now Army counterintelligence, this highly secret command sector which in 1947 operated almost as much in the civilian sector as it did in the military, had spun up to its highest alert and ordered a full deployment of its most experienced crack World War II operatives out to Roswell. CIC personnel had begun to arrive from Washington when the first reports of strange radar blips were filed through intelligence channels and kept coming as the reports continued to pile up with increasing urgency over the next 48 hours. Officers and enlisted men alike disembarked from the transport planes and changed into civilian clothes for the investigation into enemy activities on the area. They joined up with base intelligence officers like Major Jesse Marcel and Steve Arnold, a counterintelligence non-com who'd served at the Roswell base during World War II when the first nuclear bombing mission against Hiroshima was launched from there in August 1945, just about 2 years earlier. On the evening of July 4, 1947, though the dates may differ depending on who is telling the story, while the rest of the country was celebrating Independence Day and looking with great optimism at the costly peace that the sacrifice of its soldiers had brought, radar operators at sites around Roswell noticed that the strange objects were turning up again and looked almost as if they were changing their shapes on the screen. They were pulsating, it was the only way you could describe it, glowing more intensely and then dimly as tremendous thunderstorms broke out over the desert. Steve Arnold, posted to the Roswell Airfield Control Tower that evening, had never seen a blip behave like that as it darted across the screen between sweeps at speeds over 1,000 miles an hour. All the while it was pulsating, throbbing almost, until, while the skies over the base exploded in a biblical display of thunder and lightning, it arced to the lower left-hand 8 quadrant of the screen, seemed to disappear for a moment, then exploded in a brilliant white fluorescence and evaporated right before his very eyes. The screen was clear. The blips were gone. And as controllers looked around at each other and at the CIC officers in the room, the same thought arose in all their minds. An object, whatever it was, had crashed. The military response was put into motion within seconds. This was a national security issue. Jump on that thing in the desert and bring it back before anyone else could find it. Even before the radar officer called the 509th Base Commander, Colonel William Blanchard, reporting that radar indicated the crash of an unidentified aircraft to the north and west of Roswell, the CIC dispatch team had already mobilized to deploy an immediate response crash and retrieval team to locate and secure crash site. They believed this was an enemy aircraft that had slipped through our radar defense system either from South America or over the Canadian border and had taken photos of top secret military installations. They also wanted to keep civilians away just in case, they said, there was any radiation from the craft's propulsion system, which allowed it to make hairpin turns at 3,000 miles an hour. Nobody knew how this thing was powered, and nobody knew whether any personnel had ejected from the aircraft and were wandering around the desert. Bull Blanchard Green, lighted the retrieval mission to get out there as soon as possible, taking with them all the night patrol equipment they could scare up, all the 2.5 ton trucks that they could roll, and the base's low, boy flatbed wreckers to bring the aircraft back. If it was a crash, they wanted to get it under wraps in a hangar before any civilian authorities could get their hands on it and blab to the newspapers. But the air controllers at the 509th weren't the only ones who thought they saw an aircraft go down. On the outskirts of the city, ranchers, families camping in the desert, and residents saw an aircraft that exploded in a bright light and between flashes of lightning and plummeted to earth in the direction of Corona, the neighboring town to the north of Roswell. Chavez County Sheriff George Wilcox started receiving calls in his office shortly after midnight on the morning of the 5th that an airplane had crashed out in the desert, and he notified the Roswell Fire Department that he would dispatch them as soon as he had an approximate location. No sense pulling fire apparatus out of the station house to chase something through the desert unless they knew where it was. Besides, Wilcox didn't like rolling the trucks out of town just in case there was a fire in the city that needed all the apparatus they could throw at it, especially the pumpers. However, finding the crash site didn't take long. A group of Indian artifact hunters camping in the scrub brush north of Roswell had also seen the pulsating light overhead, heard a hurtling hiss and the strange, ground-shaking thunk of a crash nearby in the distance, and followed the sound to a group of low hills just over a rise. Before they even inspected the smoking wreckage, they radioed the crash site location into Sheriff Wilcox's office, which dispatched the fire department to a spot about 37 miles north and west of the city.